This episode of Section D was first broadcast on the 7th of October 2014 on Monocle 24. Section D is brought to you in association with Grundig. Hello and welcome to Section D, the hour we devote to the world of design each week here on Monocle 24. I'm your host, Tom Morris. Coming up today, we're heading to the top of the city to take a tour up the Balfron Tower, one of architect Ernold Goldfinger's iconic London high-rises.
This was absolutely about taking people out of those dark Victorian tenements and up into these light-filled spaces.
And then we go beneath the city to get the lowdown on the Low Line project in New York, the subterranean answer to the hugely successful High Line. How do you design data? We'll tell you when we meet the authors behind two books dedicated to the world of infographics.
It's not like just pouring something out of your imagination onto a page. It really requires a certain amount of discipline to make an infographic, a data visualization occur.
That's all here on Section D with me, Tom Morris, on Monocle 24. To start the show, we're going to stay here in London to take a look at some British modern architecture that seems to be having a resurgence in the fashions and consciousness of society. Brutalist architecture was always going to have its critics. With stark forms and unrefined surfaces and material choices, it was a style of building that many in Britain found very hard to fall in love with. As we discovered on a visit to architect Ernold Goldfinger's 1972 Trellick Tower back in August, maintenance and lack of investment was usually the root cause of many brutalist buildings' fall from grace. At Trellick in London's now highly desirable Notting Hill, good positioning quickly meant that it wasn't too long before the tower was once again celebrated and seen as a masterpiece in which people would want to live. Across town, at Poplar in East London, Ernold Goldfinger built what many see as Trellick's twin, the Balfron Tower. Completed in 1968, it's the older of the two twins, and despite being the focus of various social and art projects, it's not fared quite as well as its West London sibling. The huge tower is now largely empty, awaiting an almost total renovation. The UK's largest membership body and de facto guardian of the nation's heritage has used this occasion to move into the flat that Ernold Goldfinger himself lived in for a few months when the tower was completed. In the first of a two-part Goldfinger special this week, David Pleasant went up to flat 130 on the 24th floor to take a look at the apartment that has been dressed in furnishings and decor of the period by Tilly Hemingway of Hemingway Design.
This area is incredibly important for particularly social housing architecture. Post-war East London, of course, there had been an enormous amount of bomb damage out here, but the remaining housing in this particular area would all have been Victorian tenement housing, two up, two down, very dark, probably vermin infested, you know, not at all attractive. And so really a major new vision for this particular area was required. And cue, of course, the County of London plan created by Forshaw and Abercrombie in 1943, and then worked on a sort of public version by Ernold Goldfinger in 1945. Now, it's not until really 1965 that Goldfinger gets this major commission to create what's known as the Brownfield Estate, which is principally comprised of Balfron Tower, Glencary House and Carradale House, and these were all created between 1965 and about 1978, and they are monumental, I think it's fair to say, poured concrete buildings, and then units for living in, which are all flats, you know, ranging from studio flats right through to five-bedroom maisonettes.
And one distinctive feature of this style of Goldfinger in particular, his these kind of separated lift shafts with the connecting passageways at every other floor, something that we've seen at the Trellick Tower, and now we're seeing it here, and we're surrounded by it. It's actually quite interesting how there's a whole estate of it. It's a complex. We're at the bottom of one of those lift shafts. Should we open the door and go into one of the flats? We should say that we're up the 24th floor, the most stunning views over London. I mean, it's incredible. Maybe tell us a little bit about the kind of architecture and how Goldfinger approached this stunning kind of positioning and the views and the panorama that we can see.
This was absolutely about taking people out of those dark Victorian tenements that I described a few minutes ago and up, I mean, elevating them almost literally into these light-filled spaces. He was trying to create new streets, new East End streets, fostering community, but these streets were in the sky. And one of the other very important elements of this was that he was building high in order to free up green space below, which was a really, really key thing. I mean, actually, for the early foundations of the National Trust back in 1895, it was about offering up green space, trying to create green space for the urban working poor. And you see that then echoed again 60 to 80 years later by Goldfinger, who's writing about the importance of building high so that we don't cover absolutely every inch of green space in our cities with bricks and mortar.
And going back to the National Trust's work, in terms of this project, you've chosen to select one empty flat and recreate how it would have been at the time of the tower's construction. Is that right? Maybe tell us a little bit more about how you did that.
That's absolutely right. Let's go into the flat and we'll talk more. So welcome to flat 130. The reason that we picked this particular flat to recreate is because this is the flat that Goldfinger himself came and lived in. He was here only for 2 months, but he really saw it as his empirical duty to come and test out the architecture that he was building. And of course, he then goes on to create Trellick Tower in 1972, and he makes changes as a direct result of living in this flat, living here in the Balfron Tower. He makes changes to the Trellick Tower, for example, and perhaps most famously, adding in 3 lifts. So you know, we just came up in a lift shaft that only has 2 lifts. Of course, as soon as one of those lifts is broken, actually, it takes people hours and hours to get up to their floor. So in Trellick Tower, he incorporated 3 lifts.
So it's a split-level apartment. There's a lobby way kind of slightly lower than the main flat. We're going up the stairs, and immediately we're struck by the light. It's a very bright space, but also all the fittings and furniture that you've chosen of that period. How have you gone about selecting all that? What's been that process?
So we thought quite seriously about whether we wanted to recreate it as Goldfinger's flat, but because he was only here for a short period, we decided actually it would be better to recreate it really as the family who might have moved in just afterwards. We asked Tilly and Wayne Hemingway to come in and curate that for us. I mean, they're such specialists in mid-century modern and through to the 60s and 70s that when we started to look at who we could invite to come and do that, it was a bit of a no-brainer. So we worked very closely with them. We've been the ones, you know, helping them with some of the history of this building and placing it in its wider context. And then they have brilliantly curated items throughout the house to set it up as though it was a family home for two parents in there with a master bedroom, you know, and everything else, and then 2 children's rooms, a boy and a girl.
Okay, so this is the little girl's bedroom with a Beatles blanket and all the rest of it. Maybe we can talk about the kind of appreciation for modernist or brutalist architecture in Britain, certainly. Have you, at the National Trust, kind of been very conscious of the fact that opinion might be changing, people might be a bit more open to reappreciating this kind of architecture? Are you kind of following the trend, or are you trying to also inform people that there are these treasures, really, that maybe they didn't know about before, or there was a kind of bad reputation against a lot of these kinds of buildings? Are you quite conscious of that in your work on this project?
It's a bit of both, isn't it? And we have a sense that while some of our more traditional members may not be entirely delighted that we've taken on this building, and certainly some of the coverage that we've had has picked up on a description of this building from some years ago as Britain's ugliest building. I think at the point that it was listed, Grade 2 listed in 1996, there was quite a lot of outcry about the listing of the building. But that said, it seems to me that there, as an urban audience, there is definitely a renewed appreciation of this type of architecture.
That was David Pleasant taking a look around Erno Goldfinger's flat 130 of the Balfron Tower with the National Trust's Joe Watson. The National Trust has a special link to the work of Goldfinger, as it has, for 20 years, owned the house that the architect designed and built for himself. Number 2 Willow Road in London's leafy Hampstead. To get a flavour of this very different building, and also to see if any of the design philosophy we can see in the Balfron Tower is being influenced by his very personal residential commission, we sent our Alice Block to the house, where she was given a tour by the National Trust guide, John Escombe.
Well, we're standing outside numbers 1, 2 and 3 Willow Road. It is a terrace of three. Number 2 is owned by the National Trust, which you can visit. And the building started construction in 1937, completed by 1939. And Erno Goldfinger loved Georgian architecture. He came to London in the 30s and saw a lot of Georgian terraces. And he wanted to create a kind of repeated form that he saw in those Georgian terraces. But he wanted to use the latest techniques, and that meant a concrete frame on stilts. And that's what you've got here, but with a brick facade, because he wanted to make some concession to the locals, who did not like the proposals that were going to be put before the planning authorities. And there was a big campaign against this building initially, which he had to fight, finally won, and this slightly more modest version of his original plan is what you see today here at Willow Road.
You say it's modest, but I'm sure there are some rather incredible, well, I know there are some rather incredible things inside. So let's head inside now.
Well, we've come inside now, number 2 Willow Road, to a very modest hallway. Goldfinger, as I said, was very impressed by Georgian architecture, and the entrance halls are not particularly impressive. The main emphasis on the building is on the first floor, so the space opens up in a Georgian building. And that's what he wanted to replicate here. So the entrance hall, as you come in, is rather underwhelming, but it does start to give you a sense of what is to come, because it's here that you start to see some of the important elements of the building. You start to see the bottom of the spiral staircase, which sits in a kind of tube which runs from the ground floor to the very top.
Well, let's go up now, up this rather unusual staircase.
What you see here is all Goldfinger's design. The strings that you see between the steps and the banister was a design feature from the outset. The spiral staircase is not boxed in. They're just concrete slabs cantilevered from the central tube that we're standing in. And what you get then is light coming through these steps, reflected around the drum. So there's a rather dramatic lighting effect. Now, on my right, we go into the dining room. And yes, we are facing Hampstead Heath. This area of the Heath was much more open in the 1930s. It was the reason they chose this spot. So this large area of glazing that we're currently looking at would have really done something amazing in this space.
And this is a very light space. Would Goldfinger have had the same philosophy when he was designing and building his social housing projects? Did he have the same principles building this private family home as he did in building for others?
When Goldfinger was building social housing, he very much replicated some of the elements that you see here. Big areas of glazing and playing with height, depth and space. Now, he wrote a lot of theoretical material about the sensation of space and what that could do to you emotionally. Now, 2 Willow Road and 1 and 3 occupy a relatively small plot. These aren't huge houses. So what you see in this house is a lot of play of ceiling height, floor height, and kind of interventions which change your perception and feeling moving from one room to the next. Now, he replicated that in both his big tower blocks at Trellick Tower in West London and at Balfron Tower in East London at the mouth of the Blackwall Tunnel. And in each of those, you enter into a small hallway, very similar to here, then up a little flight of stairs onto your first floor. So these flats, so-called, these apartments, so-called, don't feel like apartments at all. They feel like little houses. So he was not interested in building rudimentary tower blocks to throw people in. He believed, like a lot of London architects from the 30s right up until the early 80s, that nothing was too good for somebody going into social housing.
And what would you say were the key principles by which he designed this place? I know it's very hard to condense an architect's entire philosophy, but what would you boil it down to?
Well, it's clever use of space and it's playing with space. Those are the two fundamentals, I think. As I said, this is not a big house. So he's used the opportunities that a concrete frame gives you in so much as he's used nearly every wall as a place which can be used for storage. So all of the dividing walls don't bear any weight. So you can have, in fact, every single wall if you wanted as a cupboard or a shelf stack or something. And he's more or less done that throughout the house. So he's absolutely maximised every last centimetre.
Let's walk up now then, up these steps here out of the studio.
We're now walking into the sitting room. What's interesting here is this repeated idea of showing the true nature of the building. And there's a particular colour which indicates when an element of the building is structural. And that colour is a kind of grey-blue. And there are two supporting pilotti here, which are coloured that colour, showing you exactly that these are part of the construction of the building. But it's absolutely, you know, said. He's determined to make you aware of that.
Was there a moral reason for showing the structure of the building, for not hiding it, for not concealing it? Did he think there was something sinister or misleading in presenting things not as they really are?
Well, I think he was very much interested in honesty with his buildings. You know, he didn't want to cover things up. And if something was there for a reason, he wanted to make that very clear.
Let's go upstairs then now to where I guess people would sleep. So we're still going up this quite incredible spiral staircase. And up we come to the top of the house. This is a really light space. And the first thing you notice is this incredible skylight kind of dome. Just tell me where the idea for that came from.
Goldfinger was a huge fan of the flat roof. By the 1930s, flat roofs in Britain were already starting to get a bad name. And Goldfinger wanted to absolutely prove that flat roofs would work, and also show off the advantages of a flat roof. And one of the advantages, where we're standing right now, which is above the entire spiral staircase, is this wonderful dome, bringing in a huge amount of light into what otherwise would be quite a dark area. One of the things that does surprise people is that this building hasn't really changed in all the years that it's been standing here, and contains all the original artwork, all the original fixtures and fittings, which for the time in the 1930s were way ahead of their time. And Goldfinger wanted to show that off in his early years and continue to do so, because he felt that there were underlying principles which would work for any generation.
That was Alice Block taking a tour of number 2 Willow Road, the house architect Arnold Goldfinger designed and built himself in 1939.
For over 6 decades, Grundig has made people's lives better and simpler. To this day, we bring our expert knowledge of design and technology to a wide range of high-quality domestic appliances. Whether refrigerator or radio, oven or audio system, we continue to integrate our manufacturing heritage with state-of-the-art technology. Grundig synthesizes the best of yesterday with the best of tomorrow, expertly and innovatively designed for you and your home. Grundig. Supreme engineering, timeless design.
Thinking of starting your own business? Want to make your company a better place to work? Keen to sharpen those ambitions? Or just like some nicer business cards? Well, we know a handsome primer that will take you from fledgling firm to established brand. The new Monocle Guide to Good Business is a 300-page plus book packed with inspirational stories, wise advice, places to locate your new HQ, and of course, great photography and illustrations too. Head to monocle.com to order your copy now, or visit any of our stores. The Monocle Guide to Good Business is a book that will show you how to do a job you really love, create a modest dynasty, use your hands and your brain, and even take your dog to work. Come on, it's time for a change.
Next, we go to New York here on Section D, where James Ramsey, founder of Rad Studio, believes that his city is in desperate need of green space. But what to do in congested Manhattan, where available space is virtually non-existent? Head underground. Ramsay is the creator of the Lowline Project, a counterbalance to the much publicised Highline, set to be the world's first underground park when it opens in 2018. Monocle contributor Nicholas Wager went along to the proposed site within the noisy Essex Street subway station.
Right now we're actually at a subway platform that's immediately adjacent to the Lowline site itself. The Lowline site itself is an abandoned trolley terminal built at the turn of the last century that's been sitting down there completely unused for over 60 years. Now, the idea behind the Lowline is that we can take natural sunlight, manipulate that light optically, and channel it down into the space where we can use that light to grow plants and effectively create an underground garden.
As a native of New York, you know that there's little green space in the city. Do you think this is going to inspire any further projects?
Well, it's our hope that the Lowline and other projects like that can serve as a template for other projects around the city, maybe even around the world. Certainly the use of technology in the fashion that we're suggesting is something that could be applied in any number of places. But going even beyond that, the idea that you could actually sort of begin a grassroots movement to create a piece of truly cherished and loved design that will actually ultimately create public space is, I think, one that's very replicable and is something that you're already beginning to see in any number of places around the world.
In regards to the design of the Lowline, how much is completely covered by RIAD Studios, and what are some of the struggles that you've come across?
Well, you know, we're lucky enough to have a fantastic team of collaborators also working with us on this project. I mean, the origin of the idea of the project is from me or us, and sort of the general design vision is something that we ourselves have fleshed out. However, we have any number of incredibly talented people working with us, from the engineering firm Arup, sort of a world-renowned engineering firm, to one of my close friends, very talented guy, Ed Jacobs, who's a motorcycle designer. You should definitely check out his work if you've never seen it. To any host of other collaborators, you know, botanists, horticulturalists, etc. And so I think ultimately the execution of a project like this will rely on the expertise in the minds of maybe like an army of people that are experts at individual components of a really actually rather complex project. Now, going forward, you know, I would imagine that the project will begin to attract even more experts in other disparate fields as well. You know, the Lowline itself is a complicated project, and so we need to tap into a lot of brains to get this thing done. Apart from the obvious struggles of the raw engineering wherewithal we need to muster, right, getting natural sunlight through the busiest street in Manhattan and down into this space to actually grow stuff, I mean, there's a host of other more subtle things that we actually have to address. How do we actually unify this sort of historical element with all this crazy science fiction technology and this greenery, right? How do we make that the tension between those actually resonate aesthetically? Or, well, this is a simple one. How do we actually get people to actually want to come downstairs and actually be in this thing, right? How do we make this something that people don't want to just see once, but actually a space that people actually fold into their day-to-day lives that they want to come to again and again? And, you know, there are a host of issues like this that actually are very subtle and actually need quite a lot of study for us to actually figure out the solutions to, that I think represent the core of our difficulties that we're grappling with right now.
With its proximity to the station where we're standing, it would get a lot of eyeballs. There would be a large crowd, and it would get a lot of public recognition. So don't you think that would factor into people just taking it after work, you know, coming in and having a place to relax, possibly, or to unwind and connect with their neighbors?
You know, I think it's certainly our hope that the space is used in the fashion that you're saying, as a place that's connected to our transit system itself, and as a means of people actually just sort of on their way home or whatever, just taking that time to stop and relax for a second. Now, I also happen to think, though, that it would be actually a really cool design feature if, okay, from this sort of pristine science fiction garden, you can actually look out and see trains go by, or vice versa. You're in a train and all of a sudden there's a glowing green jewel off to your left, and you're like, what the hell is that thing? I think, you know, that sort of two-way voyeurism is actually, possibly a really powerful design feature.
Something like that sounds very exciting. You bring up personal note to this. What are some other possibly ideas that you would like to incorporate or maybe unattainable but are fantastic in their own way?
Well, I mean, one of the things that fascinates me most about New York City, and actually most cities in general that have grown by accretion and have been around a while, is the idea that you can actually explore lost elements of them, right? And so I feel like a part of me wants to make a portion of the Low Line its own kind of crazy, psychedelic, spelunking experience where you're actually going through and you maybe don't know what's lurking around the corner. Maybe it feels a little bit foreboding. Now, of course, that has to be something that's balanced off in the real world against practical considerations of safety and just sort of, you know, general well-being, I guess. But it would certainly be something I would like to try. And of course, that's something that has to be balanced against a whole set of practical considerations, like public safety or just a general sense of well-being in the Low Line space itself. But the idea of exploring this sort of sense of discovery and the sense of mystery is at least in some part something that I would love to explore.
That was Nicholas Wager talking to James Ramsey, founder of Rad Studio at the Low Line. Still to come today, we're staying in New York, where our bureau chief sits down with Jerry Helling of Bernhardt Design. And then we'll be having an in-depth look at the sometimes technical, sometimes artistic world of infographic design on the launch of two new books on the subject. Jerry Helling is president of Bernhardt Design, a US global leader in furniture design based in North Carolina. Alongside curating designers from around the globe, it's also heavily investing in domestic talent. New York bureau chief Ed Stocker caught up with Helling over lunch when he was in town to find out more.
Jerry, tell me, what is it like working for a family business and one that has such a prestigious history dating back 125 years?
I guess I have to say it's really great because I've worked here for 27 years. It's the only job I've ever had, and it's the only job I've ever wanted. I think most people find it, sometimes there are peculiarities with working with a family company, but this one, the family is so amazing, and it's so rare that a family business has gone on four generations, and all the generations have been talented and allowed the business to grow and change and keep up with the times. So I'm happy and proud, I guess.
Tell us a little more about what Bernhardt Design does in terms of the pieces it produces and how it curates designers from all around the world.
We make furniture across a wide category of product that the common denominator is that it is high quality and it's tested for commercial use. We find designers all over the world. We have designers from Paris, El Salvador, Norway, Los Angeles, and they range in age from 15 years old to 82.
Wow, quite a spread there then. But tell me also, despite this spread, you're still producing the furniture in North Carolina. How important, especially with the state of the industry, I guess, how important is it to have that made in America tag?
It's very important in our business, first and foremost, because we make everything to order for the customer in the colors and the finishes that they want. And to be able to deliver that very quickly to people, you have to make it here. And it's additionally important to the community that our factories are located in North Carolina to provide them with jobs in the future. The town where our factories are located is Lenoir, North Carolina. It's in western North Carolina. It's a small town. It's been a factory town and a family town for many years. We recently had the celebration of our 125th anniversary and had a day for the employees, and we had over 3,000 people show up, and it was quite amazing to see generations of people that had worked there, from grandparents bringing their grandchildren along for the day.
Do you ever find it's hard to still remain in the States despite the fact that you need to be, because it's made to order, and just because I guess a lot of furniture that's now made overseas in Asia is much more competitive in terms of price?
I think it's a challenge, and it's a challenge in any business. I think it's an education process for people to teach them why something is more expensive made in America and why it's better than a disposable object made in China or somewhere else in Asia, that there's a certain level of workmanship, materials, handcrafted attributes and quality that goes into something, and that it's going to last much longer.
Well, Jerry, you're a busy man because you're also involved in an organization that's called Be Original. Tell listeners a little bit more about that project.
Be Original is an organization that we started up in North America a year ago, and I'm the first president of the organization. And our goal is to educate people about the importance of original design and why they should care, and how original design is different than knockoffs, what they can expect with original design versus knockoffs, and how it affects the entire food chain of an industry when knockoffs become a common accepted item.
Okay, and how do you do that? What's the kind of active work you're doing to try and stop counterfeit goods taking over?
The first role is education, and the media has been really helpful in helping us tell the story and helping educate people about what the differences are. We do a lot of speaking events and have exhibitions and try to have interactive events where people can learn. Pervasive knockoffs can destroy entire industries that are almost impossible to bring back. And we believe that when people completely understand all the ramifications, they're more than likely going to make good decisions.
Well, we're in New York, so it seems apt that we should talk about something from here. And you're very much involved in New York Design Week, and particularly in nurturing young talent from America and further afield. Tell us a little bit about the studio that you have here in May every year.
The name of the program is ICFF Studio, and this is our 10th anniversary. It's one of my favorite projects that I'm able to work on. And the goal of the program is to give opportunities to young designers. We have a very loose network of support for design in this country, very little government support, very few programs to help and nurture new designers. So each year we choose 10 or 12 of them and give them a shot. It's really interesting to look back at the history of some of the people that were in the studio 10 years ago. I was recently in London at the London Design Festival, and one of the first participants is ICFF Studio, had a major exhibition in London. Another one owns a very successful company in Los Angeles. And there are stories looking through the year, it's kind of like a high school yearbook or something, of seeing what's happened to these people and the careers they've been able to craft for themselves.
That was Monocle's New York Bureau Chief Ed Stocker speaking to Jerry Helling of North Carolina-based Bernhardt Design. As promised, we now have an in-depth look at one very specific area of graphic design, that which deals with the display of information. We're living in the golden age of data visualization, where infographics have never mattered as much as they have today. But how do graphic designers and illustrators respond to the information overload of the digital era? The book Raw Data takes an inside look at the private sketchbooks of these designers, from the doodling process to the final product. Stephen Heller, editor of the book and co-chair of the MFA Design Department at the School of Visual Arts in New York, spoke with Monocle's Carlotta Ribello about the art and craft of infographic design.
The idea came from a series that I've been doing with various co-authors. We did one on graphics, we did one on typography, another one on comics, and this is just the logical extension of that.
As soon as you open the book, this is an intimate look at the private sketchbook of illustrators and graphic designers, because as soon as you open it, you can actually see or try to imagine how their creative process was, from the doodles and sketches you have and then to the actual result. Tell me a bit more about this book and how you visualized it as well.
What I visualize in terms of sketching is the pure process. Sketches can be doodles. Sketches could be fully formed drawings that haven't been finalized yet. Sketches are notes and notations. Sketches are rough drafts, but also ways of seeing where the artist is going to take the next step. So for me, the infographics, because they're so complicated, it's not like just pouring something out of your imagination onto a page. It really requires a certain amount of discipline to make those things happen, to make an infographic, a data visualization occur. So seeing how the different people in the book handle their early inspiration, their early instincts, and their early gathering of data was to me quite fascinating. And there's so many diverse ways of approaching it.
Do you want to give some examples of how the people featured in the book approach it?
Well, what's great about Nigel Holmes, for example, one of the pioneers of infographics, he just sketches away. His work is based on icons and symbols, but he has a lovely drawing style that really doesn't come through in the finished work. But that's how he gets to the place that he's going. He just lets his mind wander and his images wander in that stage, and then he firms them up and refines them for the final stage. John Grimwade, who is the graphics editor for Condé Nast Traveler, he's a really Renaissance-like artist. I mean, his work is representational, but very detailed and very beautiful. And so to see his sketches is to see a master putting down the first bit of what will be an opus, because each one of his pieces tends to be opus-like.
Looking at the book, there's a huge amount of diversity in the styles of infographics. You have some that are obviously more newsy and others are, we can say, more institutional in a way. How did you find a balance between what type of infographics to feature? Was it mainly aesthetics? Was it based on the doodles? How did you find this balance on what to feature on your book?
Well, we threw out a dragnet, really. Anybody who had done infographics, or what we at the New York Times used to call sides of beef, because they looked like butcher charts. Anybody who was working in that medium, we invited to send us material and got an overwhelming response. And so the diversity just came from the simple fact that we called on so many different people. Some of them are very heavily into data visualization and work for newspapers or magazines. Others are doing infographics as part of their general practice. Infographics has increased markedly since the onset of the computer, whereas Time Magazine or Newsweek or the New York Times might have had a few infographics in the past. Now it's part of the journalistic language. It's part of the diet that people get on a daily basis, even an hourly basis.
It's much about transforming these complex ideas, especially now that it's an age of data visualization, basically, and trying to transform these ideas in infographics that not only need to be clear, but also engaging. And that's very important as well, isn't it?
Engaging is very important. And as you flip through the book, you'll see that some of the infographics are actually quite personal, and therefore they're quite entertaining in a strange way. Tim Hucklesby, who's an English designer who's living in New York, he charted out through infographics all the movies that he watched in the course of a year. And he created a Mandela, so to speak, of films. So on one hand, it's an autobiographical piece. On another, it's an exercise in how to take that very unique and eccentric data and make it into something that everybody can understand and enjoy.
And as you were saying earlier, going back to the doodles and the sketching, it can even be just a simple word or a play of words that eventually will lead to an infographics in the end.
It's true. And there's also, in addition to wordplay and picture play, there's just emptying your mind like a data dump. One of the pieces in the book that I truly love, and I'm so glad we have because the designer died a few months ago, is Massimo Vignelli's sketches for the New York City subway map. And Massimo Vignelli was not an eccentric by any stretch, and he was a rationalist and a modernist, but his sketches are so wonderful, they're so pure, and they don't live by the restrictions that he put on himself as a designer. And it's for an iconic piece of work.
Yeah, I'm having a look at his sketch as we speak. And in fact, it's one of those iconic pieces of work that stays with you. Can I ask you to tell me, which is your favorite sketch? Is it this one from Massimo Vignelli?
You know, everybody who asks me that gets the same answer. They're all my babies. But I'm very proud to have Massimo's piece in the book. But I'm also proud to have other pieces in the book because many of these artists almost go unnoticed because there's so much infographics in the media now.
And just before we head off, a last and easy question. What was your biggest lesson on revealing this art and craft behind the infographic design?
That it's not all computer driven, that it still relies on the hand and the mind and the hand and the mind working together. You end up putting the stuff into the computer and it makes it a refined piece, but it starts with doodling and it starts with sketching and it starts with musing.
That was our Carlotta Ribello speaking to Stephen Heller, editor of the new book Raw Data, which was published by Thames and Hudson and is out now.
Grundig's goal is to bring the best of the world's entertainment into your home. Its digital and DAB Plus radios allow you to access an unlimited choice of broadcasters from around the world and to listen to them with the most superior sound quality. Its new Bluetooth-enabled audio products let you play music from your smartphone. Grundig is committed to making sound crystal clear, whether it's beaming in from the other side of the world or from a mobile right next to you. Grundig, supreme engineering, timeless design.
The menu isn't just about food or drinks, it's about the people with innovative ideas, the ones who savor traditions, and the ones who are willing to go further than most in search of the most delicious ingredients. Whether it's an author who's discovered true adventure through food, or a master bartender traveling the world in search of new and exciting flavors, the menu uncovers the tastiest tales from around the globe.
We are finally walking to the simple way of eating, being, but I think it's a universal trend, this kind of simplicity.
As well as going behind the scenes with top chefs such as René Redzepi and Massimo Bottura, we find out the latest in restaurant design, the creative culinary experiences keeping city dwellers' taste buds tingling, and what Japanese clubbing culture and noodles have in common. Join me, Markus Hipp, before the menu, premiering every Friday at 1900 hours London time.
Given that this area of graphic design seems to be so appreciated lately, it's little surprise that another book is being published on the field. Understanding the World, the Atlas of Infographics, sets out to be the definitive overview of the different trends and best exponents in the field. I spoke to the editor Sandra Regren on what is, for a rather specialist field, something with an extremely broad remit.
Well, what we've tried to do is put together a comprehensive collection of infographics, so to speak, like an overview of current practice. And we looked at mostly journalism and what NGOs do in this field. Like, a lot of NGOs use infographics as a tool for their communication as well. And so first we collected a lot of material, and then we mapped out some chapters, like some major themes of looking at the world, trying to understand major problems and major issues. And so we came up with the five chapters that we have in the book now, which are nature and environment first, and then science and technology. And then the third one is economical topics and development issues. And the fourth one is social issues, and then we have a chapter on culture and media. And so those were our milestones along which we kind of mapped out the book and put together the collection of material.
Tell us where it all began. I mean, I kind of associate infographics with very sort of, you know, modern day things of corporate annuals and things like that. But actually, some of the earliest examples of visual explanations were people like Leonardo and Descartes, weren't they?
Yeah, well, there's a very long history of information graphics. I mean, we have historical examples that date back a few centuries even. So it's kind of hard to put, like, a mark on where it all started, like, in total. But I would say, like, in earlier times, it was always linked to particular, like, single minds, like single innovators and particular scientists who were working on some specific problem and then turned to graphics to explain something. But there's never been such a burst of using infographics like we had today. So the 19th century, for instance, where people tried to visualize statistical data, a French engineer, for instance, who tried to map statistical data on geographical maps. Or we have someone in the 1920s, Otto Neurath, who tried to put together exhibitions for a general public and explained sociological facts and for that devised a visual language. But in my understanding, that was always like the work of particular people. In the last like decade or something, we have this absolute burst of information graphics and a lot of gifted designers and scientists too who are working in the field and are trying to devise new forms of visualizations.
But what is the fundamental point of infographics? I mean, it's to disseminate information much more simply than it could be done in a paragraph. Is that the case? Because, I mean, a lot of these amazing ones in the book are actually really complicated as well.
That is true. But I think they have various potentials. Like, they can do various things. Showing structure in an issue that is seemingly very chaotic. Sometimes it would be making statistics intelligible. So if you have statistics, that's just a column of numbers, basically, and you can't really read it in that sense. And diagrams, for instance, can make it intelligible very fast. So they can show trends where you would have to read numbers and numbers and numbers, so that makes it faster, right? Another potential is to present complex problems in an orderly way, right, to show a structure or something. So I think it's hard to say there's this one thing that they can do, but they can do a variety of things, and their particular power always depends on the information that you want to convey. But I guess why we are turning to information graphics and to visualizations is that, in general, our forms of communication are turning into something more visual. Like, we want to look at things more than to read long paragraphs. And I also think that the shift to digital media totally changes our forms of communication. And that's why we work with shorter text, with stories that are made of various components. And infographics and visualizations play an important role in that shift, I believe.
Yeah, our shorter attention spans, fundamentally.
Well, maybe not necessarily, because as you mentioned, some are quite complex, so you actually have to read them as well. But it's another way of reading, maybe, than reading a long text.
Mm. And in this book, we've got everything from the solar system to genetic differentiations of the human species or the ocean food chain. It must be difficult to choose, but have you got any particular favourites that you just, you know, when you first saw, you just, you know, it was like opening a Pandora's box of amazing information brought to life visually?
One of my favourites is a historical example that we have very much in the beginning. It's called the Animal Clock, and it was made in the 1930s. And it shows how life on Earth evolved in the time span of one around the clock, which makes you understand that man only has been living like the past 5 minutes of those 24 hours. And this is an example where in one gaze you can understand something that is very hard to perceive or very hard to imagine. So that may be a good example of the power of information graphics.
Absolutely. And, you know, you sort of said we're going through a bit of a golden age for infographics at the moment. Are there any particular parts of the world that do it really well? Because it seems to me quite a sort of Central European discipline.
Central European, yes. And maybe also there's a lot of information visualization going on in the United States, of course. There's also a community down in Southern America. And I believe that Asian countries are picking up on the topic, but I would have a hard time to distinguish that more into detail.
Finally, what do you hope the reader will come away from when they look at this book? Will they sort of revalue how they see information to be produced and shown?
I would hope that they get a sense for the power that information graphics have in explaining complex matters. I would also hope that learning about this power doesn't entail that people just take everything for granted that they see in information graphics. I would also hope that people still keep a skeptical eye, right? That they still try to look at things skeptically and say, so what is this really telling me? Like, what's the point here? And what's the database that people are working with when they present you information visually? Because sometimes people take for granted things that are presented in a nice graphic, but it's still necessary that we keep to be critical readers, I would say, in texts as much as in information graphics.
That was me speaking to Sandra Redgan of new book Understanding the World, The Atlas of Infographics, which is published by Taschen. And that's all we've got time for in this week's edition of Section D. Today's show is produced by David Pleasant and edited by Alex Funnell. You can contact the producer, David, at dmp@monocle.com if you'd like to feature on the show or if you've got any comments or questions. And following on from our special on Ernest Goldfinger, here is, of course, Goldfinger by Shirley Bassey. I'm Tom Morris. Thanks very much for listening. Bye-bye. Go!